You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, February 4th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
So,
hello.
Hello.
What's up?
I don't have this day.
No, you don't. We don't have anything. No science or fiction. No who's that noisy. No this day. This is a special extra episode of the SGU. We have 15 listeners on a go-to meeting with us. And what we are going to do is take live questions. And that's going to be the whole show. We will take questions one at a time. And we'll let the listener ask their question. And then we'll chat about it. How's that
sound? Good.
I'm at the tail end of a really bad cold, so that's why my voice sounds like crap.
I can tell.
Yeah.
You sound like crap.
When I woke up, I had almost complete laryngitis.
This morning, you mean?
Is that a technical term? That. Almost complete laryngitis?
Yeah, I mean, I basically was
partial
making
laryngitis.
Squeaky noises. All right, so who wants to ask the first question? Okay, so Mike Hampton is the first one.
Hi, guys. Hey, excited to be here. Hey, I want to quickie with Bob.
Oh.
All right. I wanted to go first because the question I wanted to ask, you guys actually covered on your Friday show, so I was a little bummed about that. But so I'll kind of lob a speculative one I think is for fun, is what would you guys like, what discovery do you guys would just love tomorrow to wake up and see in the media? And not the media reporting some sensationalist headline, but actual for real scientists have discovered blank, and it be for real.
For me, that's easy. I want SETI to have the Encyclopedia Galactica being picked up by one of our radio telescopes. I want an unequivocal intelligent signal from an alien civilization.
I'll settle for the primes. You don't have to be the whole encyclopedia. You know, I'll settle for just that.
I would go with a cure for cancer, even though, like, that's so ridiculous because there are a billion cancers and each one is a different cure. But I would think some huge medical breakthrough would be the ideal one for me. Because I think we should have that stuff sorted out before we get to seeing the aliens.
See, we're never going to have that sorted out. Because
it's sort
just,
some
it's
of it
just
out.
Going to make us live longer, and then we'll die of other stuff, and then people will be saying, "Well, we have to cure that thing that we're now dying from before
we'll
we contact
cancer.
Aliens."
All right, well then I'll say a cure for death.
Bob, what's my answer?
Yeah, it does not do anything else until we cure death.
Yeah. A cure for Peronis? I don't know, Jay.
Peronis?
No, that's not it.
Is that a beer?
I've
a
be-
food.
A cure for Sharknadoes. Zombies are real.
Artificial intelligence? Nanotechnology?
Yeah, it was artificial intelligence was the first one, and the second one I thought of was definitely unraveling the idea of aging, like what makes us age. Because that really does solve most, if not all, medical problems.
Well, I'll just comment that a good fusion between Rebecca and Steve is, in fact, the Encyclopedia Galactica, because that would be information that we could use to then develop cures for cancers and lots of other diseases. So I could, those two would work together very nicely.
I feel like that's cheating though. That's.
Well, fine, but it's true. If it's a true Encyclopedia Galactica as Sagan envisioned it, then yes, it's not cheating. That's just the way it is.
All right. Well, then I hope scientists discover Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay. I would have, my first thought actually was fusion, which would be epic.
Mm.
But I could do a lot better than that. I think artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that's the one I'd go with.
True artificial intelligence. That would, yeah, sure, it could cause a singularity and they could exterminate us as vermin. But that's just a risk I'm willing to take. It would be,
that you're willing to take that risk.
Yes. Such a civilization changer right there. All bets are off and it could. And
see,
it,
that's
it
why I didn't say aliens landing on Earth because they could exterminate us as vermin. Yes. But, you know, a signal from light years away is pretty safe.
Yeah, but imagine the virus that they can have encoded in that message and bring our civilization to its knees.
Great. That's all right. We already cured death.
Mega virus.
Yeah, I don't fear the singularity. I would definitely go with that because
bring
the singularity
it.
Would bring so much with it. I mean, it's going to happen eventually anyway, so why not when we're alive?
Don't Fear the Singularity is my Blue Oyster Cult cover band.
How about Faster Than Light Travel? We have to
never going
to
happen.
All right, then how about this? How about Wormhole? Harness.
Yeah, that's okay. All right.
No, I love that, Ev.
Yeah, you'll just have to travel 25,000 light years to get to a black hole to use that wormhole.
I love how everybody's picking apart Evans. Encyclopedia Galactica, why not?
Hey, that could be bathing the Earth right now. You don't know.
True.
Mike, do you have an answer?
Yeah, actually, mine wasn't too different from yours, Steve, but yours just was bigger. I would accept, discovering life elsewhere in our own solar system would be cool, even if it was just single cell, like bacteria that went extinct 3 million years ago. Even that would be like really, really cool.
That would be cool.
Not as cool as intelligent life, but I would accept that, you know, tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Mike. That was a great question.
Tor, what's up, man?
Oh, very little. It's in the middle of night.
Where are you?
Wow.
Two.
Must be Norway.
Norway, yes.
No way.
My question is kind of hard. It made a lot of noise amongst my friends. It's about teleportation. I guess you know what that is.
Here we go.
I'm sorry.
Yes, you die. Get over it.
Yes, that's my point too.
He's agreeing with you, Rebecca.
Would you use this machine to get from A to B? The question is about the fact that you die and then get reproduced at another place with new atoms, right? Would you have used that machine?
Would we use it?
I'm going to say that all of them are a no. None of these guys would.
So Tor's question is, would we use a teleporter that involves destroying you at one location and recreating you in another location?
No way.
Yeah, no way.
Absolutely, yes.
Because
yes, I would. Yes, because you're gonna die anyway. I know that this is difficult for EJ, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, but not today.
Yeah, but I.
You're gonna die anyway. Yeah, right.
What? I'm just gonna shit away my 40 years I have left, and
no, because there's no difference between you as you are right now and an identical copy of you 20 feet. That way. There's absolutely no difference.
Yeah, but the only difference that is perceivable is me.
It's a different set of atoms.
But it's not perceivable to you. It would absolutely not be perceivable to you. You would reappear as though you were over there and now you're over here.
Yeah, to everybody else, but I am right now would actually be dead.
So what? What is you?
I've talked about, argued, and damn near came to fistfights over this topic many times, so I think I have my final word on it. It's okay for you. It's not okay for me. I'm not doing that.
I'm just saying that there is
rebuilt with different atoms. Really like go right ahead. But you formally die, and I don't because I choose not to go into Tor's teleporter. I will go into Evan's wormhole.
And both of us end up exactly the same.
No, like, I will enjoy the rest of my life while you are a pile of atoms blowing in the wind. I mean, it's a profound difference.
No, I would be standing over there because there's zero difference between the me that is here and the me that has teleported over.
But
there.
Your
zero
consciousness,
difference.
The consciousness that was R1 is gone.
No, it continues over there.
It matters.
Because
only matters to the...
But Jay, what you're saying...
Yeah, but Rebecca,
what you're
it's
arguing
a copy.
Right here is that... There is something unique and special. There is a ghost in your machine. And I don't believe that. I believe that
I disagree. I think that's a false
up
premise.
Of the atoms in our brain. And when if all of the atoms in me are recreated right over here, then that consciousness is
Well,
recreated.
What about the idea? Let's say that to dip into, 100 sci-fi stories, let's say that the machine breaks during the process and forgets to destroy you, and now there's two of you, right? Just follow my logic. So now there is
things are about to get sexy.
Original Rebecca. Yeah, they look at each other and run into the next room. No, there's original.
Is it incest or lesbianism?
There's
Who cares?
Original Rebecca, and then there's the copy of Rebecca, which is clearly
for
not Rebecca because it's just a copy of Rebecca, right? Just as human.
No.
And all that. But then the machine. Or the people operating the machine go, oh, shit, This thing didn't work, and we now got to kill the original Rebecca because...
What? No, what kind of horrible people are these that would just kill a sentient life
form?
What's
the difference? They're killing you when they dematerialize you, aren't they?
Wait, what?
Oh, my God. Like Rebecca, this is easy. No, we haven't even gotten into the weeds yet, and I already stumped you. Yeah, so...
You haven't stumped me. No, not wanting to be murdered does not equal being okay with dematerializing here and rematerializing there.
But it's not murder, Rebecca. You have your duplicate. It's not murder.
Because now I don't have a duplicate that will be continuing on. Because if you were to murder me, there's like that other being is already in existence. So now I have gone on living for a period of time that is not going to be a part of this.
So what's your limit then? Five seconds, 10 seconds?
You know,
I want it to be immediate.
All right, but you're saying, though, that it's not you're not dying as long as there isn't an overlap between the two Rebeccas living. And what I'm saying is that if you just remove the idea of another one being brought into existence, you are being expunged from existence.
Yeah, and that's what I was about to say, is that I get that for a lot of people, the teleportation problem really freaks them out. But for me, the first time this occurred to me, years and years ago, for me, it was like, it makes me okay with death because who cares? because if there were another me materializing somewhere, I would be absolutely okay with it. So it's actually gone a long way towards helping me come to terms with death.
Nice.
Well, I'm fine. If it's fine with you, I'm fine with that for you. It's just not fine for me. And that's like my new modified answer.
I'm not going to push you into the teleporter.
So Rebecca, you're saying you're fine with it, but you're not discounting the notion that your continuity of consciousness will have been broken. That what you are experiencing now is yourself would no longer exist. The fact that a copy of you exists, while to the outside world it may be identical, it's still not you, and you would have no awareness of that copy's existence.
But it is.
And you're just okay with that.
I would have no awareness of anything.
Right. You'd be in oblivion.
That's what we're trying to avoid that.
I mean, there are people. I've argued.
But you can't avoid
I've
it.
Argued with people that actually.
I could delay it.
Actually don't think that there's a breach in continuity. I mean, and I don't even know how to respond to that.
I don't think that there's a breach in continuity.
Sure there is.
I see what you're arguing as a breach in continuity, but to everyone involved, from everyone's standpoint, there is no breach in continuity because I am dead and can't imagine anything. So there's nothing there for continuity to break. I cease to exist. But the copy
that's
of
the
me
problem.
Has perfect continuity. Everyone who's watching is perfect continuity. So what's the point? Who cares?
I just have a problem with you being fine saying, I am dead. See, those words, I just can't get past those words, I am dead. I got a problem with that.
But it's going to happen.
Most people do.
Of course it's going to happen. Then I'll just kill myself right now. It's going to happen.
Okay. The thing is, you aren't dead. Well, you will be dead in the process between when you are transferred, but you won't be dead because I view it like... I'm just reduced to information. And if that information is lost, then I am lost. But if you can then use the information to put me back together again, then I will be the same person.
Yeah, I agree with Tor. You're not dead in any meaningful sense of the word dead.
But the idea that, you know, first of all, there is something kind of metaphysical about what you guys are backing or describing, because there is nothing inherently special when you get down to the atomic level. They're identical, right? So a hydrogen atom is a hydrogen atom, whatever. So there could be a million exact copies of you at that instant, or one, or none, right? It's, you know, we're looking at is the idea that inside of your mind, you know, the creation of your consciousness in the configuration of cells and atoms and molecules and everything that makes up you, there's nothing inherently special about that meat. There's nothing inherently special about anything other than the particular configuration at that moment as your consciousness exists, right? So if we made a copy of you, the other human would be just as relevant, just as, you know, with all the rights of a human being and everything. But the fact is that those other atoms and that other configuration are not you. They are somebody else that is identical to you. There is an absolute difference between those two beings.
Tor, I think, hit the nail on the head when he said that as long as the information is there, the information is him. But that is the question. Are you just the information, or are you the substrate that holds the information? That is also relevant to the notion of whether or not you upload a virtual representation of the information you're into your brain into a computer. Is that then you? Or does it have to be the information and the substrate? We're not going to resolve this question tonight, but that's the question. And I think you have, it's the substrate and the information, not just the information. That's my opinion. But anyway, I did write a very long blog post around on this exact question. There's like hundreds of comments following it. So if you really want to get into the weeds, you know, look that up on Neurologica.
Thanks for the question, Tor.
All right. Thanks, Tor. All right. Next is Duncan.
Not too bad. Not too bad. Interesting conversation so far. Just a quick question from me. And just based on what's happening tonight, the Ken Ham, Bill Nye debate is ongoing as we speak. I managed to see a little bit of it just before we come on. But my question for you guys is, you know he's going to pull the Gish Gallop. You know he's going to throw all these kind of apologetics out there and all sorts. How would you kind of handle one, the Gish Gallop, but how would you wrap up? What would be your selling point at the end of that debate?
Duncan would like to know what our final wrap-up would be to convince a creationist like Ken Ham, because the Ken Ham-Bill Nye debate is going on right now, actually, as we do this. And I did a YouTube video this week with my tips for Bill Nye, and the main takeaway was that, like, the main tip is when a creationist asks if you want to have a debate, you say no. Absolutely not. So I would like to say that I would never be in that position, because I would never agree to debate, particularly Ken Ham, at the Creation Museum during an event where they're selling tickets to the Creation Museum. Because it's just, to me, it's a lose-lose proposition. Not to say that all debates are lose-lose propositions. I do think that some are good and have their uses, like, you know, showing people in the audience that there's another side to things. You know, you're never going to convince the person you're debating, but you could influence people in the audience. But in this case, like, this was such a huge losing proposition. I wouldn't do it, especially because I've never done a debate before. I think debates should only be handled by people who have extensive experience debating, who have studied debate. You know, Bill Nye is not a debater either, which is why I don't think he should have done it. So unfortunately, my answer to the question is nothing, because I would never be in that situation.
Yeah, you definitely have to control the venue. I think the big problem is the Gish Gallop. There is no answer to the Gish Gallop, which is essentially throwing out a bunch of questions or misconceptions. You know, in 30 seconds, you can create a misconception that would take 5 or 10 minutes to unravel and deconstruct. And so, the creationists like Dwayne Gish, what the Gish Gallop is named after, would do that, would create 100 misconceptions about evolution. And his debate opponent could never possibly address even any significant fraction of them. So there's really, once that's happened, you've lost, in essence. You have to control the venue, the format, the moderating, whatever, so that you can restrict the questions to a few key areas and do a deep dive and follow up and not allow the other side to just evade, and just Gish Gallop and keep bringing up new topics, rather than ever being forced to address the previous lies or distortions or misconceptions.
I saw the first hour of the debate before this recording started, and to say he did a Gish Gallop is just beyond, like, that he went so far beyond Gish Gallop. Ken Ham was on stage arguing against gay marriage and abortion. That's how far off the rails he got. The topic was evolution and creationism.
We'll have to call it the Ham Hammer.
So, yeah, I mean,
the hammer.
It was
hammer time.
it was so off the rails. It was just embarrassing for everyone involved, I thought.
That's too bad.
To Steve's point, the problem with coming up with those kinds of parameters is, you know, you're probably not going to get the creationists to agree to those.
You can. No, I've seen debates, you know, where that were carefully moderated, like in venues like, you know, NPR or something, but not at the Creation Museum.
Yeah,
that's
really
basically, now Bill Nye is a prop for a publicity stunt for the Creation Museum.
Yeah.
That was the problem.
Yeah, getting him to show up to that debate was a victory for the creationists. That's it.
You have any follow-up questions, Duncan?
No, I was just curious. I watched the first hour as well. I thought it was great. I'm not a debater myself, so I'd probably just not get in the situation like Roberta says, but
Thanks, Duncan. Hey, Kevin, you're all set.
First of all, I want to say you guys are awesome.
Thanks, Kevin.
Cool. I don't really have a science-y kind of question, but, you know, this happened a few weeks ago, and I listened to a lot of podcasts, and I really haven't heard anybody talk about it too much, so what are your guys' opinion on it? The net neutrality, like, court decision that came down, basically saying, you know, trying to get rid of net neutrality. Personally, I was going to see what you guys' opinion on it was. Personally, I think the judges were high, but, you know.
Yeah, it's a travesty. I mean, the judges were convinced. It was a really, really poor decision made with incredibly well thought out arguments to trip them into believing that it actually makes the net more fair and that, you know, people will, it's kind of like, people will get what they want more this way, which is ridiculous. They were tricked into making a horrible decision.
Did they actually pass something recently? I haven't been following.
Matter of fact, actually, I was just looking up before the call, see if there was any updates. The court decision basically came down that ISPs can now block websites that they think are, well, for any reason, actually, which was one of the...
Yeah, like as an example, they can block streaming, you know, from Netflix if they wanted to.
For some reason, I just didn't realize that it had passed. I guess I've been very much out of it.
It came out in the news recently, I think just today, that I think a Senate bill came out trying to reestablish net neutrality, trying to overturn the court decision, which I'm really hoping that passes. But
if there were net neutrality and Netflix were allowed to just, you know, hog up all that bandwidth, what would happen to everything else? All right. And wouldn't that kind of be sacrifice a bunch of other things that, you know, we all use the internet for?
Yeah. And the real fear is that they will charge you, you know, for certain particular types of downloading or streaming or whatever. Like they'll, you know, charge you depending on your use or the kind of use. And that's bullshit. You know, you get into a service plan with someone where, you know, you're getting 50 meg down a month. Or, you know, 50 meg down a second or whatever, you know, your package is. And, you know, they want to start slicing and dicing that up and picking through what you're doing. It's terrible. It's just everything about it is wrong. It's just one of the worst things that could happen as far as the internet and share of information and privacy, everything.
I agree.
Yeah, that was my opinion, too. I was just wondering if there's maybe some angle of this that I wasn't quite seeing. But
nope. You're right. It's bullshit.
Yeah, and another listener that's on tonight, Jeff Edwards, said something that I also thought. He said that they could ransom Netflix for a premium handling of their packets, meaning that they'll say, "Hey, Netflix, you know, we're not going to block you if you pay us $10 million a month. We'll you know, allow you to have a quote unquote premium package with us for delivery." And it's just bullshit.
There is just yesterday there is a proposal by Democrats to restore net neutrality. But you wonder if the judges, again, sometimes were they judging it just as a matter of law? I mean, their job is not to legislate, but to just interpret the law. If they were just saying this is what the law allows, then the solution to that is legislation. It may be something that could not be resolved in the courts, and just means that we need to pass laws to unequivocally establish net neutrality.
I think Jenny was the next one that asked. Hey, Jenny.
Hello. So I'm Jenny Pohl, and for a good kid, I think we're teaching to be critical thinkers. So my question is, what was the first or most memorable thing you remember your kid saying, skeptical thing?
Oh, that's easy. Just yesterday was my son's first birthday, and he clearly said Apple.
Very skeptically.
He was so skeptical when he said it.
So when my older daughter was about 4, maybe 5, the topic of God came up for the first time. And so I was explaining to her that, you know, some people believe that there is this being. And I said, you know, different people in different cultures believe different things about him, et cetera. I went through the whole thing. And then, she, you know, she took it in and she looked at me and she goes, "You mean like Bigfoot?" I'm still not sure what connection she was making there.
A very clear one.
Jesus was very beardy.
God was like, God was like,
that's awesome.
My favorite fictional character.
That's Steve. That's funny because my daughter had a similar kind of reaction. I'll never forget reading her some bedtime stories. We're laying in bed together. She's probably 5 or 6, and out of the blue, she just said, "I don't want to be a Christian anymore."
Wow.
And now my ex-wife was a Christian, and I was an atheist, but I never pushed it at all because she probably would have killed me. But I never really, I didn't want to force it down her throat. But when she asked me questions, I would say, "Well, some people believe this and other people believe this," and so on. And she just kind of figured it out for herself. And it just amazed me. At 5 or 6, she said, not only "I don't want to be a Christian anymore," she said, "But, you know, where did God come from? And then what about God's parents and their parents?" Which I thought was pretty insightful for a 5 or 6 year old to think, well, all right, if God exists, and where did he come from? You know, and I never thought of that at her age. And that was like one of the proudest moments. And I actually wrote it down, her exact words, because I never wanted to forget it. And so that in terms of being skeptical of something, that was her first real skeptical moment. And that made me very happy that she was really thinking about it.
Evan?
Oh, yes, Rebecca, I was waiting for you, but no.
Yeah,
no. Not quite there yet, are you? My daughter's first science question came when she was like 4, and she was asking if ladybugs can be boys. That really fascinated her by that term. So that was a very
cool
science question. And later,
and of course, you said no. You were like, "No, they're ladybugs."
Just like how cats are girls and dogs are boys.
Well, our friend Bug Girl actually helped her answer that question. So, hat tip to Bug Girl.
That was when we had Bug Girl on the show, wasn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that. Yep. That was very cute.
Yeah.
Hey, Jenny, do you have kids?
No, just foster kittens. They're not very skeptical.
Yeah. Well, they are, but they're just not sharing it with you.
All right. Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks, Jenny.
How about Oak?
Good evening. Thank you very much for having a chance to talk to you all. My name is Oak. My question is for Jay.
Is that like Prince or Cher?
No, actually, that's my real name.
That's Oak. Cool.
Is it your whole name?
My whole name is actually Oak Rajate. But the last part is unpronounceable for most folks.
So. It's an unpronounceable symbol.
It's a classy name. That's a classy guy.
No, I was saying if you make a roast, you go with the oven or with a crock pot?
Oh. Good question.
All right, so I
never asked the chefs in the restaurant's kitchen, but I'll ask them next time I'm there.
I'll go with crock pot. Slow cooking all those delicious foods and stuff in that crock pot is very, very tasty.
I gotta disagree
always
though.
Comes out nice.
You can't do a roast in a crock pot. And I say this as a vegetarian, although I have made delicious nut roasts before.
He says he's.
But no, you have to roast it in the oven. Like a roast is very different from what you do in a crock pot. Crock pots are great. And I use mine all the time, but it's a different flavor and a different texture that you get versus a roast.
Yeah. But if you're right. But if you're thinking of the pot roast as the cut of beef, you absolutely could do that in a crock pot. We do that because, you know, my wife and I both work. So this is something we could set up. Let it slow cook all day, and then we come home and it's ready.
Yeah, and hope the house.
I mean, I would say the answer is both. There's a few different ways that you could pull off a pot roast, but I mean, I think traditionally I like searing it, and I like putting it in a big pot, not a crock pot like a slow cooker, but just a big pot on the stove
pan?
with a sealed top at one point.
What's the consensus with chefs in terms of slow cooking? Is it generally considered to be more flavorful or just a better way to cook if you have the time to slow cook?
it maximizes the concentration of the umami.
Umami?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're going for. You know, like what kind of textures and what kind of taste you're
going Rebecca's
for.
Right. I mean, everything I cook in the crock pot has, you know, the umami roundness to it. Another huge thing we do with crock pot in our house is, we'll, at 11 o'clock at night, we'll put in, oatmeal. So it'll be, you know, oatmeal, skim milk, cinnamon, apples, craisins.
In a crock pot?
And some sugar and a little bit of butter. And, you know, 7 hours you get up and, oh my God, like talk about epic breakfast. It's so good. And the whole house smells like cinnamon oatmeal and it's amazing.
It's a good idea.
Wow. And for our listeners who may not be aware, umami is the fifth basic taste. It is essentially the savory flavor of meats, and it's essentially receptors for the amino acid.
Yep. Glutamate. And that's what MSG is suspending.
And so it's slow cooking releases a lot of glutamate. You know, meats release a lot of glutamate. But Oak, I have a question for you. Why do you care what we think about cooking?
Because obviously we have good taste.
Oh. Is glutamate only released when you slow cook it, or is it something in other foods?
It's not only released with slow cooking, but it's maximized by doing that. So chefs have kind of learned how to do it over the years, not necessarily realizing that's what was happening, that the science behind it. And it was actually controversial for a while whether umami really existed until it was discovered, you know, that it absolutely is real.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Oak.
Okay. Next person up is, did James Edward Gray II go? That's an awesome.
I say, that's an
awesome name.
I'll ask a question from a friend of mine because I liked his better than mine. So thanks, CJ, for the question. It is, what can we learn from our biggest successes and our biggest failures in this skeptical community?
Wow.
Well, that's big, good.
What can we
big
learn
questions.
From our biggest successes and failures in the skeptical community?
Wow.
that's hard.
That's a big question. I would say things like libel reform in the UK, things like that. I think to me, most of the big successes come from grassroots activism that is supported by larger organizations, but not to the point of it smothering them. So for me, I would say that one thing that we can learn from the big successes is how to properly use crowdsourcing. You know, our big successes tend to be petitions, people, you know, calling representatives, you know, actually motivating people to get up and do small things in order to make a difference. And so, I think wise skeptics who want to do something, good for the world will look at how to motivate those large bases to do things.
Yeah. I look at it like, where has the change taken shape? You know, I think about, the Australians fighting against the AVN and, their success with vaccinations. It's work like that. Real world successes that make the movement worthwhile. It's not just educating people about critical thinking. It's that, you know, the changes that we've made to the world are where it's at. That's going to have a lasting effect and affect the most people.
Well, I agree that it's easier to perceive some concrete benefits when we have like an actual agenda, like stopping the AVN or stopping Stanislaw Bozinski. Or whatever. There's something very specific. We mobilize the troops and we embarrass that the net troll or whatever. We rally behind Simon Singh and get libel reform done. Those are all great. But the other kind of quiet success, I don't think we should downplay it or ignore it. And that is just participating in the conversation in the broader culture. Like, I know we've brought up on the show before the idea that like 9/11 conspiracies really were marginalized and placed on the fringe, I think, because of the active participation of the skeptics in the online conversation about it. So even though there may not be an immediate tangible result, I do think we punch way above our weight in terms of our impact on the broader conversation and the culture because we have our shit together, you know? So if I would derive a lesson from that, I think we're most effective when, as a community, we're on the same page. And I think that in terms of our failures, I think we get tripped up when we fragment, when we allow ourselves to be compartmentalized by ideology. And we start behaving as subcategories of skeptics rather than putting the critical thinking first.
Yeah, completely agree on your second point. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate all different kinds of activism. I don't think there is any one way to behave as a critical thinker, absolutely. And I think we have to allow people to have specialties and allow people to do whatever kind of, you know, whatever kind of activism that they want. And I don't like it when people say my activism is the right kind and yours is the wrong kind. I think that's where the community tends to fall apart.
I have a similar feeling, but I guess to me, I'd make it more specific. Like what I see as huge failures tend to be when we are closing in too much and, you know, focusing too much on when we're not focusing on expanding outside of our current group of dyed-in-the-wool skeptics, when we're doing so much preaching to the choir that we ignore the fact that there are people out there who have larger concerns that skepticism would be an amazingly helpful tool for, but we don't care about those issues, or we don't give people platforms to talk about those issues. So things like stop and frisk laws, you know, do they work? How are they affecting people? These are things that people have to deal with on a day-to-day basis and can cause considerable pain in their lives. And it's really helpful, I think, to use critical thinking as a way to examine policies like that. And the more we do that, the more we open up skepticism and critical thinking to a larger swath of people who can find real comfort and real progress through it.
I want to bring up an entirely different point, too. And that is, I think, in terms of the lessons from our failures, believing that because you have the critical thinking skill set reasonably developed, that that qualifies you to talk about anything. I think that too often we see people who are self-described skeptics who, you know, may know some of the basics of skepticism, and then they get totally in over their head on topics that they do not have mastery over. And this could be true, I think, of every activist skeptic to some degree, myself included, all of us included. You know, it's very tough to commute. We're science communicators, critical thinking communicators. And just like, you know, you think about any science communicator out there, at times you're going to be talking outside your area of expertise. And it's really tricky to navigate that. But I think when we forget to be really cautious and humble outside of an area of legitimate expertise, then, you know, the greatest risk we run is being out there as a representative of the community and then doing a hack job of something we don't have mastery over. We have to be really, really careful about that.
I was doing an on-camera interview last week, actually, and the topic was about a particular conspiracy theory, but then it veered into unified field theory. And the questions I was getting got to the point where I was like, look, I'm going to tell you the basics of unified field theory and why it has nothing to do with this conspiracy. But if you want to know more, please go talk to a physicist because I don't want to get the angry letters when this goes on TV.
Yeah.
You know,
sometimes you have to be able to say, you know, I've done this in interviews. So I just refuse to ask questions saying that's too far out of my area of expertise. I don't feel comfortable asking and answering that question.
Yeah.
That's fine. Just say no. Just don't feel obligated.
I do that all the time.
To go somewhere. Yeah. Just don't. Just
I do
just
that
beg
more
off.
than
you know,
make
that's
statements.
Okay. No, it's fine.
But that's okay.
All right. Thanks.
How about Malcolm Sneglove? Snellgrove. There he is.
Third time's the charm.
G'day, my name's Malcolm from South Australia, Malcolm Snellgrove, so you got that right in the end, Jay.
In the end.
First off, excellent work with the quality and engaging format of the show that really makes it worthwhile listening. But my question is, given that there'll always be people who fall into believing a whole mess of potentially dangerous things, what will we need in terms of organization or organizations to keep the skeptic message going into the future and sort of growing? Is activism enough? Can it stay there? Do we need more?
Education reform.
Yeah.
Education reform, I think, is where it has to happen, because we're not nearly teaching the students at the younger grades the critical thinking skills, logic skills that they need. They really need to be on this stuff much earlier in life, and there's no reason why we shouldn't be teaching them that, and that is sorely lacking, certainly in the U.S. system, I find.
Yeah, and if you guys want to, if any of you are educators, check out one of our newest sister sites at Skeptic is schoolofdoubt.com, where it's all educators from different disciplines, different grade levels, who are talking about how to incorporate critical thinking into their lesson plans. And it's not just science teachers. It's, you know, English teachers, music teachers. And I think that that's necessary. I think it needs to happen on a large scale basis, is people need to, critical thinking just needs to be the undercurrent of our everyday lives, not an afterthought, not something that waits until sixth period science to come into play. So I agree with that.
I think we need to do everything. We need to do everything. We need to focus on actual in-school education, lifelong learning, the media, educating journalists, you know, social media, and stuff that we haven't figured out yet. We need to keep experimenting. I do think that we need to make certain aspects of skeptical activism profitable, because, you know, where there's money, there are resources. You can get stuff done. You know, we're basically doing as much as we can do with no resources. I'd like to see what we could do with actual resources. I think that would be an interesting experiment to run. I don't think we put all of our eggs in any one basket. I think we do everything that we can.
And, you know, and I mentioned this in answer to the other question, but the other way to me to keep critical thinking relevant is to discuss relevant issues and how critical thinking applies to them, issues that are relevant to people's everyday lives. I think that a lot of us got into this because we like things like Bigfoot and psychics. You know, I love talking about that stuff, but so many people out there that's a fringe belief. That's a fringe interest. But when we talk about vaccines, for instance, that's something that billions of people are concerned about and need help with. So I think that opening up our list of topics that we cover, goes a great way towards keeping critical thinking relevant and interesting to people outside of our spheres.
All right. Thanks, Malcolm. Jeff Edwards. All right, Jeff.
Hi. So this is Jeff Edwards from Seattle. My question is, who was the person? Yes, thank you very much. We're very
pod.
Happy about that. Well, we just won the Super Bowl. So.
Oh, right. That too.
Yeah. So first score in both the first and second half within 12 seconds. Anyway, so my question was, who was the person that surprised you most where you first thought they were a great skeptic, but quickly proved you wrong?
You mean other than Bill Maher?
Oh, God, yeah. Bill Maher's a big one.
My particular example for me, because I hadn't paid attention to any of his stuff outside of his comedy before I saw him speak otherwise, was Joe Rogan.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's another good one. Comedians are ripe for it, apparently.
Follow-up question, do you have an inverse of somebody you thought wasn't skeptical but turned out to be a great skeptic?
Ooh, those are good. We gotta.
For me, the first question, someone I thought was skeptical and turned out to be anything but, was Ben Stein. Because I knew that he was an economist, you know, and a professor and, you know, certainly a man of education and had some very valid things to say along those lines. And guess what? I wake up one morning and I find out, oh my gosh, he's an unapologetic creationist. This guy is awful. Turned him off, turned off forever at that point. Forget all his economics and everything else. I mean, at that point, he just absolutely ruined it.
Yeah, Ev, I couldn't agree with you more, right? I mean, he is so not skeptical. It blew my mind.
Yeah, but I never really thought he was skeptical. You know, maybe intelligent about this and that, but not, I never really thought of him as skeptical.
Yeah, Mike mentions Ira Flatow. He has said some weird stuff.
Oh, Ira.
And also Robert Krulwich has said some some like iffy stuff on past episodes of Radiolab that I found. Oh, and yeah, Jane Goodall. Good one, Damien.
As well.
Ugh. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and, she was like.
They tend to, like the Ira Flatos, I mean, they tend to have a blind spot when it comes to alternative medicine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the one that seems to get everybody because it really does require a pretty sophisticated, I think, understanding of lots of things like placebo effects, et cetera.
Jane Goodall wasn't just about Bigfoot. She plagiarized parts of her last book and plagiarized from an insane alt-med naturopath guy. It was really disappointing. Super.
So I have a, and I can Richard answer Atten. The other question. Mark Cuban was a big surprise coming out as a skeptic, or, you know, I don't even know if he identifies himself as a skeptic, but that man is a skeptic.
He has supported 9/11 truthers.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Has he given up the loose change stuff? If I haven't seen anything definitive on it. Yeah. He has. Good for him.
I think
him
he's just avoided the topic.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think he has kind of just ignored it.
I think he's cool otherwise.
Yeah. I think.
Yeah.
But what it shows you, though, is that it's not an all or nothing black or white proposition. Right. I mean, there are different sort of critical thinking skill sets, and you can have part of it but not all of it, you know? And it's also knowledge bases. It's not just the critical thinking. It's also specific knowledge bases. So, like, Mark Cuban's a good example. Within his area, I mean, you know, you watch Shark Tank. There are some segments where he is right on the money in terms of the skepticism, but – outside of that area, like a conspiracy, he just may not have the conspiracy theory module in his
criticism. Well, I think with him, this is a wild guess, but my gut's telling me that it's more of he just doesn't have the information. I think if you were able to have a real conversation with him about it, he'd see it and then he'd do a 180 on it.
Yeah, for me, thinking about the things that the people that surprise me, it's not because I expected them to be dummies or anything, but more just that there are a number of people who I've met in random places and through random circles of friends who I don't expect to, even though they might be skeptical, I don't expect them to be excited about critical thinking and science and skepticism, but then they are, and it pleases me. Like, one would be Frank Conniff and Trace Ballou and Bill Corbett, like all of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 guys. Well, not all of them, but the ones that I've met have all been like, I've met them in various circumstances independent of one another and had told them what I do and they get really, really excited.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question. I think Damien has not gone yet.
G'day, Riggs. Okay, so my question for you, Damien, is what is the worst argument you have ever received from a climate, evolution, or vaccine denier?
How about,
Classic. Let's see.
So I was listening to the debate that Bill Nye is currently doing, and the orchard that he came up with for the tree of evolution, Darwin's tree of evolution, he came up with the orchard of evolution, saying that 6,000 animals went on the ark. And I thought that was just ridiculous. So that would be mine. What's yours?
I mean, the banana has got to be a perennial favorite.
Yeah, it's hard to top that one easily.
Ray Comfort's banana. Top banana, got
it. Which even, it was so bad that even Ray Comfort had to eventually be like, you know what? I take it back.
Did he really?
Like,
too late. I missed that somehow.
He did, yeah. He did. He admitted that the evolutionists had a point and that it was the wrong argument to make.
Good for him.
So, yeah.
I think he just got tired of people throwing bananas at him.
Yeah, I think he was tired of all the dick jokes, really.
I don't like the...
I bet he still believes it, though, Rebecca.
It's curved and it fits in your mouth.
I hate the God of the Gaps. I hate the whole... Because we don't have an absolutely exquisite example of fossil to fossil, you know, with amazingly subtle transitions. And then when we find one that's perfectly in the middle of fossil A and fossil B, you know, then they just go to the middle of those, you know, the two new middles that were created.
Two more gaps.
That's such an insult to everything in my brain that actually has logic. It makes me sick.
Yeah.
It's also that peanut butter jar argument. Like, why can't life arise from a peanut butter jar?
Yeah. Why hasn't it?
I mean, obviously that person's never seen my peanut butter jars. But that sticks out in my mind as a particularly poor argument. Then there's the classic. There's the, you know, if we came from monkeys, why are there still monkeys? Which, like,
yeah, that's the one
I still see. Like, people still say that.
Oh, sure.
All right. I'll give a very specific one since the other ones were, some of them were, the others were generic. If you recall, the creationist neurosurgeon Michael Egnor once argued that if evolution were true, then cancers should evolve into new organisms. But they you know, why?
Why doesn't cancer evolved make our brains? Into Michael Egnor.
If you have brain cancer, that should make your brain function better, right? Because the brain, the cancer cells should evolve into a better brain.
Yeah, I had a wart once that became sentient, but not cancer. That's just too much.
Next question,
Eric
and Matthew. A twofer.
Hello. Our question is, where do you draw the line between being skeptical and being confrontational when speaking about, like, pseudosciences and non-science-based things?
The two aren't mutually exclusive. I know plenty of skeptics who are very confrontational and many who are not.
Yeah, they're kind of independent variables.
Yeah. My style is usually, you know, confrontation has its confrontation can work if you're, you know, depending on what your goals are. Sometimes it can work really well if you're just trying to convince people around you and not the person that you're arguing with. But for me, in my day-to-day life, I avoid confrontation at all costs, which I know a lot of people are like, what? You know, I usually take a more humorous kind of approach, like a very easygoing approach, unless somebody is talking about something that could actually kill them. You know, we've talked before about the idea of just planting the seed, plant the seed of skepticism and critical thinking in their brain and then walk away, because you're never going to convince somebody in the moment when you're fighting with them. And that's a mistake that a lot of people who are confrontational, I think, make.
This is Eric. That's what I try to do with a family. If we're walking through like a county fair or something like that, and there's a chiropractor there, an acupuncturist, they want to engage us in conversations, and I will sort of ask them questions, you know, to actually let them prove their points or make points. And my children, Matthew and my daughter when she's around also, sometimes think that I'm embarrassing them. They understand, my son especially, since he's become a member of the community. But sometimes it's a challenge, and you know, I don't want to come across obnoxious.
Yeah.
But, you know, more so to my family than the other people, because I really don't care what the stranger thinks about me.
Hey, if asshole skepticism worked, we would have won a long time ago. It doesn't work well.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I think being an asshole does work sometimes. Lots of people see someone being an asshole and it gets them all passionate about being an asshole too, or just being skeptical. You know, sometimes it's enough to jar someone out of their thought process. You know, sometimes it works, but I think, like, on a day-to-day basis, like, if you want to make friends and influence people, being an asshole isn't probably your best bet.
Yeah, there's so few people where I've seen that actually work. It's really tough to pull off. I wouldn't recommend it for most anybody. I wouldn't even try it, because it's so hard to pull. You have to have a knack at that to make it an effective form of communication, at the very least for your audience, if not the person you're being confrontational with. But Rebecca, I think you nailed that answer. You hit all the key aspects to it. I mean, I'm similar. I'm not very confrontational at all. And I like, because when you confront somebody, the shields just go up and you're not going to get through, only except in very special circumstances. So I like plant the seed, say your bit and let them think about it, and don't even expect them to change their mind quickly. If at ever, really. But if you do give it that those seeds, then months or even years down the road, it could bear some fruit.
You know, everything is measured by degrees as well. I mean, you know, when are you actually being an a-hole versus being passionate or forceful or whatever? I mean, you get more flies with sugar than you do vinegar, and I think that follows in this. I mean, it takes a long time to change somebody's mind that's deeply seated, has, you know, deep roots of non-critical thinking, whatever. Like, I just find through my, you know, 25 years of skepticism that I've done a lot more good by being nice and patient. Every single day I have to bite my... No, it is. It's a constant struggle for a lot of us, because we want to push it out there the easy, fast way, which is, you know, getting hot and yelling at people, or just getting loud, and it doesn't work.
Well, you know, poop does catch the most flies.
It does. Yeah, I mean, if you're on Hitchens level, go for it.
Yeah, you got to develop your own mojo, and it's also very situational. So you really can't give one answer. You got to titrate the confrontation and the style to the target audience, to the situation, to your goals. And you just have to, you know, I don't know that there's any magic formula. You kind of have to figure it out as you go along. But pay attention to the outcomes. I mean, if you're not paying attention and you're just doing what your emotions dictate, you're probably going to be getting into trouble. If you're actually working the situation and thinking about how people are responding and what kind of results you get, you'll work it out.
So, Element point. X, or his name is Gary Evans, his mic isn't working. So his question is, as someone who does not have a deep background in science, but has come to realize later in life just how seriously interesting it is, I'd like to know if there are any resources that you think do a particularly good job of making the basics of the major physical concepts accessible to the non-specialist. I'm interested in both resources for adults, but also for my son who is 10. Thanks.
It kind of changes over the years because there's always newer ones coming out and older ones become dated. Like Cosmos, I think is still a good resource, and young kids can appreciate it. And it's not that dated. A lot of the stuff is held up. Of course, the new Cosmos is coming out in March. We're all looking forward to that. Yeah, with Neil deGrasse Tyson. So I think good video, like good TV series like that are a great place to start. It's just a matter of finding the good ones. I like the ones where, you know, it's not just a series of talking heads and a voice. It's actually a host who's crafting the message and taking you on a journey. I like that style better, the Cosmos type of style.
For kids that I got to play with the ebook version of Dawkins' Magic of Reality. I think that's what it was called, Magic of Reality. It came out like last year or so, and the ebook was really well done, I gotta say. I thought it, like, if I had been a little kid, I would have loved it. There were like little mini games to play as you read along with the book. It was really cool.
There was a physics teacher that did an audiobook on quantum physics and relativity. His last name was Wolf, and I think it was for the teaching company or one of those course companies. It was amazing. He just gave you an awesome, one of the best primers I've ever heard or read for general and special relativity and quantum mechanics. And it was based on the idea of, this is the problem with physics at the time, and this is why relativity or quantum physics fixed that problem or filled that gap or solved this mystery. And he just brought you through the whole process of what was going on and why they needed these new theories to come in and answer these questions. So if you could find that, I'm sorry, I can't find his full name, but his name was Wolf, and it was an amazing teacher. I learned a lot.
Go ahead, Isaac.
I wanted to ask, do you think that the drive to pass on your molecules is an antiquated artifact of evolution? It just seems that where technology is headed, biological reproduction seems unnecessary and in some ways a little selfish.
Let me answer that question from a specific point of view. Then I do think, and this is a kind of a hand-waving evolutionary psychological explanation, but here it goes. I do think that, psychologists have identified that we do have this inherent notion of essence, which is really interesting. Like, for example, if a child has a favorite toy and you play a magic trick on them where you pretend like you're duplicating their toy, they will not accept the duplicate because it's not really their toy. Whereas if it's not a favorite toy, it's just something practical or just a toy that's not their chosen favorite one, then an exact duplicate is a perfectly fine substitute. So why is it? Why do we have this sense that there's some magical metaphysical essence in that being an exact physical copy isn't sufficient if it's not the actual original thing? It probably, I mean, it's, I don't think there's any one simple answer to that, but I imagine that the parenting instinct might have something to do with that. You want to know that the child you're taking care of is your actual child, and like being replaced with a substitute that looks very similar is not acceptable. It's got to be your actual child. So I think that it's part of that bonding, and that does seem to be replicated in, you know, children who have a favorite toy that they imbue with a personhood and essence, etc. It's the same kind of thing. So that's, I think, just built into our psychology, and you could also think about the survival instinct, you know, that you want to survive yourself, you know, because that is what leads us to behave in such a way that makes us survive, right? That's, we evolved from people who wanted to survive. I don't know that you really need more of an explanation than that to explain why we feel this way.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. I agree. The what do they call that? The it has there was a cool word for
agency.
When something is given agency, you know, it takes on a completely different idea in your head than something that you haven't imbued with it. So
I don't think it's necessarily agency in that context, Steve. I think another way to interpret it, and the parenting example you gave might be. Is really good and probably more powerful, but it's the idea of a duplicate. Yeah, it's a duplicate, and it would function and serve as a perfect stand-in for whatever that thing was. But that history that you had with those atoms isn't there with a duplicate, and that's kind of how I interpret that whole idea of, you know, this thing is special because we go way back, you know, it's that thing. It's that exact thing. It's not the duplicate you don't have that shared history with it and memories of that specific thing.
Yeah, I guess I was more interested in like your guys' feelings on if it's still a necessary drive. Like eating fatty foods isn't really a necessary drive anymore. Like we have plenty of access to food. We don't need to like go eat food. We can't. Is it still necessary to want to have kids? Like, or is that just an artifact of our evolution? We can kind of like try and not do that now.
Well, yeah, but we don't need to have kids anymore to what standard though? I mean, what do you mean? Like, because like, let's say that singularity makes everybody immortal, you know, it's according to how long the universe is going to last. Doesn't mean that the human race can't expand beyond the boundaries of Earth and continue to grow and everything like that. Right. Is that what you're talking about?
I guess a bit. It was more that, if you are mortal, then you don't need to reproduce. Like,
there's no longer a necessity to reproduce as much as you possibly can because most of your babies are going to die in infancy and things like that, you know. And there's no need for most people to reproduce at all in order for the human race to continue on as is because of gross overpopulation at this point. So, yeah, I mean, I think yes, but that doesn't mean that, you know, just because the necessity is no longer there, of course, doesn't mean that the need disappears, unfortunately. So you could get down to that old question, like, is it selfish to have kids, you know, when you don't actually need to have children and, you know, it's only going to increase the carbon footprint and whatnot. And I don't think we're quite at that point yet. No matter how many breeders jokes I make to my friends who are all popping out babies right now, present company included. So yeah, I think it's not necessary anymore, but, you know, people are going to keep popping out kids for the foreseeable future.
It's part of the
human condition.
Human experience.
Right.
Yeah, and it's part of being a person.
I think even in the distant future, if we ever reach this point where we're actually designing our kids, you know, we're going to want to design them, even if it's not genetically, you know, it'll be algorithmically. We'll want to, you know, imbue them with something of ourselves. It's just, yeah, part of being human.
I would design mine to look like a cat.
That I think will be with us for quite a while.
Okay. Next question. Jonathan is, I believe, our last person to ask a question. So we're going to be turning his mic on and.
Well said.
Hello.
Hey, Jonathan.
Hello. All right, guys. I have been stressing out all night wanted to ask a question. My question is, with Stephen Hawking's new idea of that there isn't a defining line of what is and isn't a event horizon.
Right.
What does that have to do with the holographic principle?
It all has to do with information. It has to do with how information.
His new idea preserves information because quantum theory says that information cannot be created or destroyed. You can't get rid of it. And that was part of the problem with the event horizon. The information goes in the event horizon and that's it, never to be seen again. So that was a big problem. But when they looked at the event horizon quantum mechanically, it's this big firewall of death.
But with the holographic tie-in, Bob, is that the information on the shell, if you will,
like
on the
four-dimensional shell of the universe
is equivalent. It's equivalent to all the information inside, right? That's right. That's the whole notion of the holographic universe that all the information necessary to describe the entire universe can be accounted for on an out the outer edge of
even
whatever the
yeah, but the, even it was
the event horizon of the universe.
Even with it, what's within event horizon would be there.
Yeah, but I mean, it's all just a mathematical, you can mathematically, you do the formulas and everything, and you could show that there's the same amount of information, on the outer edge versus the entire volume in the middle. So therefore, you only really need that outer edge, and you can apply that to the universe, or you could apply it to a black hole to try to solve the information paradox with black holes, and that's as deep as I could really go into it.
I wouldn't say there's a strong connection because black holes and some type of event horizon exists, whereas this whole idea of a holographic universe, that's completely speculative. That's way kind of out there stuff. So I wouldn't even really, worry too much about that right now. I'd focus more on, what he's saying about the event horizon and the apparent horizon and the firewall. But yeah, the holographic stuff is really – really out there, and I haven't heard of any direct connections between it, but yeah, it does have to do with information and how it's preserved, as quantum mechanics says it has to be preserved.
Well, guys, thank you so much. What a cool night. I really appreciate the questions, and
this was fun.
Yeah.
Let's do it again sometime.
All right, well, yeah, thanks again to all of our listeners for joining us on this live Q&A special episode of the SGU. And guys, thank you for joining me again.
Thank you, Steve,
and thanks to everyone who joined us. Have a great night, everybody.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah, we got to do this again, guys. It was fun.
And until the next episode, actually not a full week away, just a few days away, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.